Okay. Hi, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I am Halsey Heyer, and I'm a part of the in-store staff and the event staff at White Whale Bookstore. And so tonight is week 5 of the Hemingway's series, and it's just been such an honor to get to be the, you know, co-host, you know, to Joan and Chris for the last few weeks. So that's very exciting. So just a little bit about White Whale Bookstore quickly. White Whale is a general interest independent store located in the Bloomfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. And we're taking a mini summer break from workshops and events because we've got lots of other things to work on. And if you haven't heard, we are expanding into our building storefront next door. And we've still got a handful of fantastic readings and conversations lined up for July and August. And in addition to that, we're open for browsing, curbside pickup, and shipping. You can find out all about these things on our website, which is www.whitewhalebookstore.com. So, if you are here tonight, there's a few other events coming up that we think you might be interested in. On Thursday, July 8th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, we're thrilled to virtually welcome Carter Sickles to Pittsburgh to celebrate the recent release of The Prettiest Star in paperback. And he'll be joined by Nick White, author most recently of Sweet and Low, for a reading and conversation. So, and then on Tuesday, July 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, it's the next week of Hemingway's. Week 6 features Nikki Allen, John Dorsey, Julia Spiker, Kasdorf, Stephen Lin, and Patricia Jabe Wesley. And on Thursday, July 22nd at 7 p.m., join us for a conversation and Q&A with Ellen Prentice Campbell, author of most recently Frida Song, and Susan Scarf Merrill, author of Shirley, which was recently adapted into a movie starring Elizabeth Moss. And you can RSVP and find out more about them at whitewhalebookstore.eventbrite.com. So just a quick note on our Zoom settings, you'll notice that you're automatically muted and your video will be off for the duration of the reading, just so that it's easier for us to focus on the readers. And we will have a moment for you at the end to turn on your video and audio and clap for all of our readers and hosts. And for best viewing, we recommend hiding non-video participants. So you can click on view in the upper right-hand corner of the video section of your screen and click hide non-video participants. And the chat in this Zoom meeting will be activated for you to only message the host, which is me, and you will not have the ability to message other users or to post public messages, but I will send the chat log to our readers along with other Zoom files. So if you want to send them nice notes or kind thoughts, please send them to me. And we do have Zoom's live closed captioning available this evening. You can toggle it on and off by clicking the CC button at the bottom of your screen, or you can click on the ellipses and that says more and go to live transcript, and then you can toggle it on and off from there. And I'm going to turn it over to Chris.
Hi. Oh, sorry. My son has entered the picture here. Hang on. Get him forcibly removed. And there he goes. Okay. Hi. Welcome to Hemingway's tonight. Thank you all for coming by and tuning in with us here on our Zoom series for the season. Thank you so much to Halsey and to everybody at White Whale for really making this season happen. We honestly could not have done this without them. So we're so happy to be partnered with them. So again, thank you. And thank you to all the readers tonight. So in 4th of July is coming up this weekend. So in lieu of any serious introduction, I'm just going to read a baseball poem. My favorite baseball poem, which is by the poet B.H. Fairchild. And it's called Body and Soul. And I actually have an audience here tonight because Jason Irwin is sitting next to me. So I'll read to Jason as well. Half numb, guzzling bourbon and coke from coffee mugs, our fathers fall in love with their own stories, nuzzling the facts up, but mauling the truth. And my friend's father begins to lay out with the slow ease of a blues ballad, a story about sandlot baseball in Commerce, Oklahoma, decades ago. These were men's teams, grown men, some in their 30s and 40s who worked together in zinc mines or on oil rigs, sweat and khaki and long beers after work, steel guitar music wanging in their ears, little white rent houses to return to where their wives complained about money and broken Kenmores, and then said the hell with it and sang Body and Soul in the bathtub. And later that evening, with the kids asleep, lay in bed stroking their husband's wrist tattoo and smoking Chesterfields from a fresh pack until everything was okay. Well, you get the idea. Life goes on. The next day is Sunday. Another ball game, and the other team shows up one man short. They say, we're one man short, but can we use this boy? He's only 15 years old, and at least he'll make a game. They take a look at the kid, muscular and kind of knowing, the way he holds his glove, with the shoulders loose, the thick neck, but then with that boy's face under a clump of angelic blonde hair, and say, oh, hell, sure, let's play ball. So it all begins, the men loosening up, joking about the fat catcher's sex life. It's so bad, last night he had to hump his wife, that sort of thing. Pairing off into little games to catch that heat up into thrilling matches. The smack of the fungo bat, lazy jogging into right field, big smiles and arcs of tobacco juice, and the talk that gives a cool, easy feeling to the air. Talk among men normally silent, normally brittle, and a little angry with the empty promise of their lives. But they chatter and say, rock and fire, babe, easy out, and go right ahead and pitch to the boy. But nothing fancy, just hard fastballs right around the belt. And the kid takes the first two, but on the third, pops the bat around so quick and sure that they pause a moment before turning around to watch the ball still rising and finally dropping far beyond the abandoned tractor that marks left field. Holy shit. They're pretty quiet watching around the bases, but then what the hell? The kid knows how to hit a ball. So what? Let's play some goddamn baseball here. And so it goes. The next time up, the boy gets a look at a very nifty low curve, then a slider, and the next one is the curve again, and he sends it over the Alice Chalmers high and big and sweet. The left fielder just stands there, frozen. As if this isn't enough, the next time up, he bats left-handed. They can't believe it. And the pitcher, a tall, mean-faced man from Okarchi, who just doesn't give a shit anyway because his wife ran off 2 years ago, leaving him with three little ones in a rusted-out Dodge with a cracked block, leans in hard, looking at the fat catcher like he was the son of a bitch who ran off with his wife. Leans in and throws something out of the dark green hell of forbidden fastballs, something that comes in at the knees and then leaps viciously towards the kid's elbow. He swings exactly the way he did right-handed, and they all turn like a chorus line toward deep right field where the ball loses itself in sagebrush and the sad burnt dust of Dust Bowl, Oklahoma. It is something to see. But why make a long story long? Runs pile up on both sides. The boy comes around five times, and five times the pitcher is cursing both God and his mother as his chew of tobacco sours into something resembling horse piss. And a ragged and bruised Spalding baseball disappears into the far horizon. Good night, Irene. They have lost the game in some painful side bets, and they have been suckered. And it means nothing to them, though it should to you when they are told the boy's name is Mickey Mantle. And that's the story, and those are the facts. But the facts are not the truth. I think, though, as I scan the faces of these old men now lost in the innings of their youth, I think I know what the truth of this story is, and I imagine it lying there in the weeds behind that Alice Chalmers, just waiting for the obvious question to be asked. Why, oh, why in hell didn't they just throw around the kid? Walk him after he hit the third homer. Anybody would have, especially nine men with disappointed wives and dirty socks and diminishing expectations for whom winning at anything meant everything. Men who knew how to play the game, who had talent when the other team had nothing except this ringer, who without a pitch to hit was meaningless, and they could go home with their little $2 side bets and stride into the house, singing, if you've got the money, honey, I've got the time, with a bottle of Southern Comfort under their arms and grab Dixie or Mayella up and dance across the gray linoleum as if it were V-Day all over again. But they did not. And they did not because they were men, and this was a boy. and they did not, because sometimes after making love, after smoking their Chesterfields in the cool silence and listening to the big bands on the radio that sounded so glamorous, so distant, they glanced over at their wives and noticed the lines growing heavier around the eyes and mouth, felt what their wives felt, that Les Brown and Glenn Miller and all those dancing couples, and in fact, all possibility of human gaiety and lightheartedness were as far away and unreachable as Times Square or the Avalon Ballroom. They did not because of the gray linoleum lying there in the half dark, the free calendar from the local mortuary that said one day was pretty much like another, the work gloves looped over the doorknob like dead squirrels. And they did not because they had gone through a depression and a war that had left them with the idea that being a man in the eyes of their fathers and everyone else had cost them just too goddamn much to lay it at the feet of a 15-year-old boy. And so they did not walk in and lost, but at least had some ragged remnant of themselves to take back home. But there is one thing more, though it is not a fact. When I see my friend's father staring hard into the bottomless well of home plate as Mantle's fifth homer heads toward Arkansas, I know that this man, with a half-orphaned children and worthless dodge, has also encountered for his first and possibly only time the vast gap between talent and genius, has seen as few have in the harsh light of an Oklahoma Sunday, the blonde and blue-eyed bringer of truth, who will not easily be forgiven. Thanks for listening to that, and let's play ball.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'm so excited to turn things over to our first reader of the night, Daniela Bacilli.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Joan. Thank you for the summer series. When I'm an audience, I'm really, really happy to be listening. When I get asked, I'm like beside myself with joy. Thank you, White Whale. Thanks, Halsey. I can't imagine the city without you guys. I don't want to imagine it without you guys. I'm going to read prose, which means I cannot just chit-chat between things. 2020 was my 50th year on Earth, and I've been writing a lot of different things. One thing I've been writing in letters back and forth with Wendy Scott Path, I'm going to just read some of those. June 25th, dear Wendy. You know how useless advice is sometimes? But the way I see it is you should put at least one coronavirus poem in that manuscript. Every manuscript from now on will be either pre-COVID or post-COVID. Also, COVID literature is a thing. The truth is political work has become a rock in my throat nowadays. I can't stand the incessant CNN blather I hear downstairs. Another truth, I've been writing love poems, but not to my husband. June 30th. Dear Wendy, A thinks I need to get out more, but as soon as I agree, I say to myself, nah, I'll become a hermit instead. The Bacillis are infamously antisocial, you know. I actually had a great aunt after terrorizing one third grade class after another, retired and refused to leave her apartment. Then she refused to allow us in. Then she refused even to brush her teeth. That's what we heard. Before she died, her in-home care nurse told us she also had Alzheimer's. But as condition of her employment, she was sworn to secrecy until my aunt died. We let her go on about the details of that last decade without questions. We envied the separateness and the quietude we imagined was theirs. One of my uncles spent his 70s tending a chicken coop, eating outside of it, sleeping under the nearby tree. Not a modern chicken raising facility where they keep the poor animals indoors. This was a half acre with a large barn coop, so run down that the shape of it was no longer clear to anyone but the oldest among us who remembered it whole. The roof curtsied down toward the ground, where the chicken stepped up to roost or stepped down to eat with my uncle in the first outdoor kitchen I had ever seen. rubble piles where three walls, where three walls used to make the corners. Rusted metal cabinets nailed to the only standing wall. Their doors dangled open to reveal a cup, a dish, a hen. Besides a pack of abandoned dogs, no one visited except to wander about him from the road. I'm sort of warning you. I have strong inclinations toward hermithood, which is best lived mad. July 17th, dear Wendy. When I traveled the border towns of Central Africa, I began to imagine changing my life, or more accurately, I considered for a moment changing the details of my life. I would be myself writing and teaching, but on a cattle farm deep in country with someone who had fallen in love with me. It was a preposterous idea, though I couldn't shake it or this person for months. Even when my work schedule occupied all my energy back home, I canceled my WhatsApp account so it was easier to make the possibilities disappear. The day after my return, my husband surprised me with a gift, something I had on a bucket list when we first met. The year of my first book, I will buy a Porsche with the money I get from the deal. There is so much of that initial wish that did not come true. There is no money for poetry chapbooks, of course, you know that. Implicit in the wish was that I would buy the Porsche. These conditions were never met, but that's how I came to have that Boxer out back, the one he restored and kept in storage until my return. I walked into the garage of a house he was renovating. I fell to my knees when I saw it. I felt electric, as in electric chair electric. It would not change my life, and whatever I was feeling would be shelved. This man, my husband, was granting wishes, as he often did for me, rendering me childlike, and him gracious and loving. I wasn't going to fly to Cameroon, after all, where there were roaming gunmen anyway, seizing the university offices or my friend work. And any change in my life faded into a naive dream. Instead, I committed myself to making my marriage more of what I wanted. He met my attempts with patience, and then with, "You're acting like Mrs. Roper." I returned to my side of the couch and to my nightly outrage about the chaos under Trump, but I thought about that old TV show, when he alluded to, a show I hadn't thought about for decades, Three's Company. I considered it as a question now. Is Three company or a crowd? June 25th, dear Wendy. A few nights ago, he took me driving in the Porsche. The roof was down and he drove into the dark countryside. The sky was clear and I tipped my head so far back, I imagined a guillotine and then I forgot it. I could not see the road or the little brick mid-century ranches that periodically appeared from the shadows. The road was mostly empty. I tilted my head far enough back that all I saw was the night sky. And underneath both of us, the car swerved and shoved us left, then right. He made the curves tight. I was selecting one song at a time to sing with the phone speaker between our two heads. Each song, he would say, "Oh, that's a good one." Sometimes we both squirmed at my off-key singing Tracy Chapman's Fast Car, of course. Beatles, Bluebird, Tom Petty's Good Love is Hard to Find, James's Laid, Amy Winehouse's You Know I'm No Good, Enzo Iannacci's Vengo Con Anch'io Not Tu No. I couldn't remember Obladi, Oblade, but then we remembered it together. My arms stretched into the air above me. The wind from the racing car was the resistance I felt, and it held me. It was thrilling. He asked me if I liked it. I liked it. He passed mostly empty buildings, the area asleep and depressed, but at a lit convenience store against a wall, we passed the dark silhouette of a couple kissing. They were the same height. They looked the same age. She had longish hair and a loose ponytail. His was a middle-aged bald head and a shapeless t-shirt. They were locked in a kiss that didn't look like a married couple's kiss. And so I let out a hoot, loud enough to reach someone outside the car, but not loud enough for the couple who didn't break their embrace or unlock their mouths. It felt mythic and magical, cinematic and meaningful. He asked me if we should get on the highway or keep moving down country roads. I don't remember saying anything clear. He filled my hesitation with, let's keep going, and I didn't disagree. It was the lockdown, but we were outside and something about it finally felt like happy. When we got home, it was as if we had been in a noisy airplane engine. And so we didn't say anything to each other until we went to bed. And in the darkness of our room, under the sheets and the ceiling fan, we talked about what we were going to do. Should we try therapy, an open marriage? He had never done therapy, so I imagine it would be too slow for what I wanted, though I didn't know what I wanted. I said, let's wait when we are out of the lockdown. In the meantime, he said, I think you're depressed. You haven't left this house for 5 months. He said, if it were him, he'd feel the same way. But luckily, he said, he was an essential worker. August 13th. Dear Wendy, today the Porsche and I were part of a parade for a heart transplant patient who survived his first year. It was A's idea to volunteer. We decorated the vehicles with blue and green streamers. He drove his fire truck, so I was alone in the convertible. I felt like crying all day, but also cupped my hands into a heart shape for the hospital workers who were waving on the side of the road. Neither A nor I knew where the patient was exactly. Had he watched the 20 vehicles circle the parking lot? What were we doing, I wondered. This sweet play in which everyone on the side of the parade was inexplicably rooting for us. That's it, guys.
Thank you so much, Daniela. And I'm going to turn things over to our next reader, Paola Corso.
Thank you, Halsey, Joan, Chris. It's great to be here. And it's wonderful to see all my students attending this reading. So I'm very happy about that as well. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. All right, I'm going to read three poems from my new book. It's called Vertical Bridges. And I'll begin first with a river prayer. And Pittsburghers, please join me in the name of the Allegheny and of the Monongahela and the Holy Ohio. Amen. I'm going to start with my title poem called Vertical Bridges. My Pittsburgh childhood, the hills where we lived, the river valley where my Southern Italian immigrant family worked in a steel mill, glass plant, and mirror works along the Allegheny. The river where my friends and I jumped in by swinging on a rope that hung from a tree along the bank, where my dad and his siblings were thrown in to learn how to swim or sink. River that floods, where my great uncle as a boy went fishing on high waters one Easter and drowned trying to save his friend. River polluted, bridges to cross. Then came a day I looked up to the hills and saw what's between. Steps. Pittsburgh is a triangle, a confluence of rivers, but my geometric view of the city began to take a different shape. The perpendicular, where horizontal meets vertical, city steps and steps in the city. People climbing them, sitting on them, shoveling and painting them. Steps to admire for their architectural beauty. steps my grandfather, a stonemason from Sicily, built. Steps my Calabrian father climbed to and from the steel mill. The more I saw, the more I realized what I had overlooked since childhood, what had come to draw my attention and why. Steps are vertical bridges, and I want to cross them. As connections in the landscape, connections we make with each other, that middle ground where we meet. And since my students are not from the Pittsburgh area, I can tell you that what inspired this book was about 700 and I can't remember now, 62, I don't remember the figure, but nearly 750 public stairways are in the city of Pittsburgh, more than any other in the country. So we hold that title and I think we're very proud of it. We have events now that celebrate it. We have the Pittsburgh Step Trek. I've co-founded an organization called Step and Stanzas to celebrate city steps, write poetry and perform on the steps. And the poems from this collection are a result of that project that I'm involved in. So a second poem I want to read. I've written about steps in Pittsburgh, but other parts of the country and the world. And this one is called, this poem is called Emergency. These are stairs in Chatsworth, Georgia. An 87-year-old Syrian woman climbs down one step at a time, one hand holding onto the rail, the other a steak knife. She slowly makes her way to a wooded area. She stoops down, reaches for dandelion greens to cut them, toss them into her apron pocket, toss them in her husband's salad bowl with lemon and garlic. Dispatcher, what's your emergency? Caller, there's a lady walking on the hiking trail. She has a knife and she won't leave. She doesn't speak English. A police car pulls up. Three officers pull out their guns. The woman doesn't drop the steak knife, despite their commands and attempt to show her how. Police tase her. Dot red, stun red, sting red, burning her skin. Electric red, shock red, enough bolts to stop her heart. That night, there's one less knife in the kitchen drawer. That night, her husband eats salad dressed with lemon and garlic. Salad without dandelion greens. He doesn't know why. And this last poem I'm going to read is called It's Golden Cast. And I read it, I am the daughter of an immigrant and the mother of an immigrant. And so I read this for my father, Mariano Procopio, and my son, Mario Cucice. My father was born on the slopes of Calabria's Aspromonte, my son, the highlands of Mazatenango in Guatemala. My father, rocking with westward ocean waves in the ship's crowded steerage, a little boy of four pushed against his older sister as they board. She standing beside their mother, holding a baby. She's too weak to breastfeed. So a goat on the boat saves my Uncle Dominic's life, the story goes. My son, 4 months old, jetting north on a plane high above the border, nestled in a snuggly on his father's chest, fed with carnation formula, burped every 2 hours as his foster mother had done. I the daughter and mother of immigrants, a generation between, the riser connecting their lives they were to tread. My father, who died years before Mario was born, who never shared his immigrant past or his grandson's immigrant future. So I show my son what I've kept of his grandfather's life. Map of Italia on a green, white, and red patch. High school class ring with a gemstone. Florida state decal. Model of his first car, a 1934 Ford Coupe. Air Force wings. Business card. And a pen with his name engraved on it. Signature stamp that he used to use as the school business administrator. Embroidered handkerchiefs, Steelers fan club pin, Italian dictionary, certificate to acknowledge his name is included on the American Immigrant Wall of Honor in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. Kennedy half dollars, the tacks and cufflinks, a stray bullet and Malocchio horn on a gold chain. Mario eyes the bullet, so I tell him a story my Uncle Frank once told at a Corso family picnic many years ago, about the time the family traveled to Canada to visit Cugini, and the border patrol stops them on the way back. The policeman asks my grandfather his name, and with his Italian accent, Francesco Antonio Corso. And when asked to see my grandfather's passport, he tells the officer that he doesn't have it on him. So the officer peers through the window of the car, sees six bambini packed in the back seat. He asks my grandfather to open the trunk to inspect for contraband. There's silence. The worry that a stick of salami or a hunk of provolone would be cause to arrest an immigrant without his citizenship papers. The officer walks back to my grandfather's window and orders him to get out of the car. My grandfather obliges and shows the officer more than his empty pockets. He lifts his shirt and reveals to this stranger what he has never shown his family. A foot-long scar across his stomach from taking a bullet in World War I as an American soldier serving his country. A bullet whose shot would pain him until his dying day. The officer signals for my grandfather to get back into the car. He waves him through. I give my son the bullet to hold in his hand. He examines its golden cast, runs his fingers along its smooth cylinder, shakes his cupped hand up and down to feel its weight. The look in his eyes tells me what he cannot say. This is what you dodge. Why? You learn to take cover. This is your will to survive. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paola. So our next reader is visiting Chris Collins. So I've actually changed Chris's Zoom name to our next reader, Jason Irwin. And then let's get you unmuted.
Okay. Hello. Great readings. It's good to be here, and I thank Chris Collins. Jenny and I are here because our power is out. So we're having a great time out on Chris's porch. I've got a couple new poems. I've mostly been writing prose for the last 2 years. But my first poem is called Poem for Jerry, where the poet goes walking in his backyard. It's about my first poetry mentor, Jerry Crinan, who lives in Buffalo. The jays and wrens sing his legend. The furry creatures call him saint, moonstruck uncle, he who dresses like a windy day, while the gnomes cast eyes of caution whenever he moves through the tall grass, murmuring his strange benedictions, his elegies to ribwort and tree bark. Each night they watch as he recedes like the sun behind the doors of his domicile. Each morning they gather like soporific pilgrims, waiting for him to come forth. And this is called Early Morning in the Old Town. It's inspired by a poem by August Kleinsoller. All right, Early Morning in the Old Town. The 5 a.m. westbound CSX rattles the loose-fitting panes. The cries and giggles of three Puerto Rican girls walking to school echo between the apartment buildings and chestnut trees. On the corner of 5th and Main, Mr. Nasca croons, "All of me, why not take all of me?" as he sweeps the sidewalk in front of the convenience store he's owned since time began. The entire town, derelict and crumbling, yawns beneath a smoke-gray sky, while the aroma of fresh brewed coffee wakes me, and I rub my eyes to find my mother, still in her nightgown, standing on the balcony, staring out into the distance as a shard of sunlight rests on the swollen knuckles of her left hand like an injured bird. I've become a stranger here, just another vaguely familiar forehead passing through, trying to recapture some lost part of myself, an expression or feeling trapped between tibia and funny bone, breath on glass, something I can call my own. I'm going to read a few poems from my book, The History of Our Vagrancies, which unfortunately came out during the pandemic. And this poem is called Chopin's Heart and is inspired by an article I read in the New York Times where they found Chopin's heart in the pillar of a church in Warsaw. Chopin's Heart. A brief apocalypse has taken possession of my person. The streets are full of melancholy. Yesterday, I fell asleep on the bus. The sound of someone crying woke me. Was it the woman slumped in her seat like a bag of laundry? Or my mother, 40 years ago, the night Elvis died, and I held her hand as she trembled at the kitchen table? In the Times this morning, a story about Chopin's heart, found submerged in a brown liquid thought to be cognac. On his deathbed, Chopin asked that his heart be cut out and returned to his beloved Warsaw. Imagine if our own hearts could be extracted and one day discovered, swaddled like unholy relics. The first known depiction of the heart as a symbol of romantic love was found in a 13th century French manuscript where a kneeling lover offers his heart to a damsel. In a tiny box marked My Tragedy, Chopin kept letters from his lover, Marie Wodinska, who refused to marry him because of his lifelong ill health. Researchers found Chopin's heart to be massively enlarged and floppy and covered in a white substance It gave it a frosted appearance. In the dim glow of my apartment, I listened to Elvis's early recordings. Obsessed with death, he visited funeral homes at night to stare at the bodies. A child prodigy and leading symbol in the Romantic era, Chopin feared being buried alive. He often had vivid dreams of damned creatures inside his piano. Outside my window, the sun has fallen behind the rooftops on Highland Avenue. I feel blood pulse through my veins, through my heart thump and flutter like a trapped bird. Each night, I cut it out and place it in a tiny box under my bed, somewhere safe, thus I wake suddenly in the pitch dark with only the dank earth for comfort. This next poem is about a bus ride when I was working at the Job Corps many years ago. It's called On the Ride Home. Tuesday was a runny nose. The bus limped and moaned over the sloping streets of cracked brick like an arthritic mammoth. In the back, a blind man sang, "How much farther? How much farther?" His baritone echoing our own unanswered prayers. How many mornings and evenings on this bus? These city streets, days spent in offices, factories, and grocery stores. At the corner of Lincoln and Leamington, the brakes hiss as sunlight cuts through a horizon of Lego-like apartment buildings. On the sidewalk, two boys jump in a puddle. Big tooth smiles swallow their skinny faces, arms flailing as water stains their boots and jeans. When the bus pulls away, I watch them dissolve into shadow, as if trapped in another time. Billboards sell redemption and cheap car insurance. I close my eyes, lean my head back, and listen to the blind man sing. I got one last poem. It's called An American Dream. It's true we want the whole hog, but disparage the butcher. We want unlimited data plans and money to burn, fantastic sex and donuts with our coffee. We want the facade of a happy life, manicured eyebrows and 401ks, to be praised for small accomplishments, sharpening the pencils, paying the bills on time, sweeping all the unpleasantness of our lives under the rug before the guests arrive. Draw the blinds, the neighbors are at it again. Frank is in his car revving the engine, blasting Born to Run, while Janet is screaming at the garden gnomes, and Mary poses in front of the bathroom mirror, practicing for marriage in the next 30 years. As if practicing prepares us, as if being prepared prepares us. Who will console us when our parents have died, when the power goes out and we stumble through the house in search of a flashlight? Look at these photos I've found in the attic, that hairdo, those pants. It's hard to imagine the people we were, the language we used. Remember those days when all we needed was a fifth of rye and a full tank of gas? Now our spontaneity is planned weeks in advance, like getting our teeth cleaned. It's late autumn, yet the oak leaves still cling to the branches, still hold on as if they understood light's brevity and the winter that follows. Yesterday, the wind kicked up
and a robin's egg fell from its nest. I watched the neighbor's cat lunge from a tangle of weeds and devour it. Sometimes it takes a lifetime to appreciate the trees, to accept how fragile we are, to let go of the torn shirt of our failures. Sometimes we die sitting at the window with an expectant glow in our eyes. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jason. I'm going to turn things over to our next reader of the evening, Rachel Menes.
Hi, everybody. I think I'm the only one reading tonight who is coming to you from a place that is not Pittsburgh. I'm in Chicago, where I currently live, and it is such a joy to get to come back to HEMS. And even though I know we're doing it in the COVID format, I'm just super, super stoked. So I'm going to read a few poems tonight from the Naomi Letters, which kind of like Jason was saying, was also a book that came out pretty recently during the pandemic. And it's been a bit of a mostly wonderful adventure kind of navigating that new world. So I am going to read a few poems set in the dead of winter in Pittsburgh. So this book was all written when I still lived in Pittsburgh, and in particular, it was written at my writing desk in our duplex in Park Place. So we lived on Braddock, right next to Ann Rashid, like right in the next to some other wonderful poets. And my writing desk looked northeast from Braddock Ave, away from the park, kind of over Homewood and into the mountains. And you can see a lot of that in the poems that I'm going to read tonight. I'm just missing it very much right now. And all of you, I saw some very familiar names in the participant list. It's really good to get to be back with everyone. It's such a fantastic series. So these poems are epistolary poems, so very much also in conversation with Daniela, with your reading. So the dates of all of these poems are their titles. January 3rd, 2017. This morning, after some time away, I opened to a random page in diving into the wreck and found you sitting there, stirring rice, ironing a skirt, typing a manuscript till dawn, trying to make a call from a phone booth. I think of that phone sex preamble, "What are you wearing?" I might ask you instead, "Naomi, where would your hands touch me first? Would they reach for my hair, my mouth, my belt buckle?" And in the time that passes until your letter reaches my door, what else and what else? Again and again. Rich writes, "Certain words occur to let me know she's a woman of my time." Here's my fantasy: sitting on the arm of your chair, watching as you labor between the various privacies of your inner life. In the dark, I see your arm moving over the page, a plane's wing casting its shadow over the city below. The felled world underneath you, bent over and dreaming. So this next one is based on a real conversation I had with a neighbor back in Pittsburgh. I just picked all of these because they make me miss Pittsburgh, which is a lot of this whole book is very much a love letter, I suppose, to not just the city, but the specific parts of the city that I really, that really sort of shaped my time there. This is January 15th, 2017. What discoveries I have made awake in the dark, what joyless shapes I have counted there. Those nights I would descend the stairs in a single leap and sit bare-shouldered on my stoop in the biting winter. I would hold my head in the frozen air until the fog arrived. One night, a neighbor even joined me. "Are you a smoker too?" he asked, his cigarette the only light between us. "Does your wife make you come out here and freeze too?" And I wept later in the empty room. What warm silence I have found here alone in the morning. Olds calls it the stillness of the quiet skirts of the dark on the ground. I reach for the light cautiously, a gift rising at my cold door. A new lover who learns the dawn air as she reaches. But Naomi, last night I slept. I disappeared from my body and returned only when I was ready. Have you brought me this impossible peace? If you have, you mustn't tell me, or else you mustn't leave me. As we move through the book, and I've just got a couple more poems left, the speaker of the collection is agitating through a period of pretty intense mental illness, which has been in a couple of the poems that I've previously read. And this one in particular is about the sort of internal, external dichotomies of kind of living in a body that is agitating in a very calm, kind of peaceful day, and the sort of weirdness of that tension, trying to describe it to somebody you care about to let them know how you're doing. And this is February 6, 2017. They say not all panic attacks are visible to an outsider. Like the morning I spent walking around the north side to find a warm place to write to you, how fear's hand grew, how it latticed my ribs and pressed so surely down. What do you want? I asked my body. What more could you possibly want? But the body bowed under pressure, crumpling to its knees in the middle of the loose-bricked sidewalk. Most days, Naomi, you'll only see fear an inch from my face. How the first words I wrote you that day, if you look closely, lean slightly to the left and quiver. So I'll end with a poem that was not in the first draft of this book. One of the questions I've gotten from folks as I've been reading from the collection is, did you write every poem in order that they appeared in the book? And of course, all of us in this room that are poets know, of course not. Like, that's never how poetry books come together. But this one having a bit of a narrative structure, when I had some friends read it after the first draft I put together, one of my friends pointed out that I didn't write a poem on Valentine's Day between these two people. And it was like, wait, this is a book of love poems. So this is the Valentine's Day poem that made its way into the collection. And it's where I'll end tonight, on a cold Pittsburgh Valentine's Day in 2017. That's February 14th, 2017. The first love letter I ever received came from Joseph, my first boyfriend. He clipped a wet peony from his mother's garden and left it on my desk. I never kissed or touched him, learning early the practice of love best tended in imagination. Today, I almost bought you Neruda's Poemas de Amor at a boutique on Butler Street. This edition was pocket-sized with a pale pink cover, a gold-pressed title, a makeup compact of poems stacked next to a pomegranate-scented candle display, a bouquet of flush peonies. Apenas te he dejado vas en mí. I have scarcely left you when you go in me. I noticed they cut La Canción Desesperada from the collection, perhaps to keep the book happy. Nobody wants to buy loneliness tonight, Naomi. But the baby pink editors forgot the 20th poem itself contains a goodbye. Oír la noche inmensa, más inmensa sin ella. To hear immense night, still more immense without her. And his prophecy at the end. Estos sean los últimos versos que yo le escribo. These are the last verses that I write for her. I stopped writing back to Joseph for a reason I cannot remember. I remember only the peony dripping on my desk, already losing its head. Thanks all. Wish we could all be having a beer together, but we will someday soon.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I'm so thrilled to turn things over to our final reader of the evening, Fred Shaw.
Okay. Hey, everyone. Really excited to be reading for the Hemingway series again. Big props to Joan and Chris for all their efforts in The White Whale, and it's been an absolute pleasure to read with with all of you folks. So as I was telling folks before we got started, my wife and I just bought our first house, which is pretty interesting, but it made me, you know, kind of start thinking about poems of place, as Rachel and some other folks have kind of touched on. So that was kind of the set list I kind of came up with for tonight. A lot of these are just recently published, and I'm going to probably touch on one from my collection, Scraping Away. So this first one is called Dwelling on Perry Highway. Side porched near midnight, sneaking a smoke, when that yellow backhoe rumbles by to quarry another rusted water line out of the cold, wet earth, somewhere off this two-lane stretching from the Gulf Coast to Lake Erie. The machine, dipper tucked and folded, front loader hinged and raised a shade, bug-eyed headlamps lighting away north, its big bouncy back tires steadily churning across asphalt, a dozen cars trailing in its diesel-fueled wake. This next one is also sort of about that place and just, you know, the idea of everything finding its place. Living on the margins. With sunlight shouldering its way through locust leaves at dawn, I watch from the bathroom window as a chestnut doe and her three spotted fawns nibble a patch of poison ivy before pawing through our compost heap. Where just yesterday I'd buried eggshells, juiced limes, and tooth-marked melon rinds, not far from where they bed. Another narrow tree line where backyards touch. Last night I fell asleep troubled over a student squatting in a vacant north side house. And while I slept, a squirrel chewed through a kitchen screen, left a Honeycrisp peeled to its core, while a whitetail topped an ox heart and a groundhog mowed my Brussels down to bitter stems, needing bark and brassica to keep his teeth from growing. This next one's from my hometown of Carnegie and for my childhood friends, Len Bogatz and Rich Knisner. It's called Penny Bombing. Loping our way down potholed streets of this company town, hucking all the news we can wrap in red gum bands, a rash of dinged up storm doors flaring as our canvas sacks grow empty. Ink stained and sweaty, we meet at the meat market stoop, our 10 cent fudge sickles dribbling while we grumble over the laid off pang and change, their pennies making our melon bank money bags sag and jingle. As remedy, one of his palms a handful, eyeing the striped steel awnings of this avenue's gray hairs, sounds of gun smoke blazing across their TVs, just before our zinc lands like a thunderclap, scaring the sparrows and jazzing us with the thrill of a getaway, our lank bodies scattering through jaggerbushed backyards, the mutts we zig past, chained and yowling at our trespass. Though we hadn't counted our trouble falling deaf on the ears of those pensioners, hard of hearing from a lifetime of millwork, it's too bad we never thought of doubling back in the thinning light, if only to catch a glimpse of them, sweeping their pine-needled walkways before crouching on a cranky knee, gathering fallen tender that brings their shallow pockets to rattle with our slag. Funny enough, I was waiting on a table 2 weekends ago and was chatting with the woman. It turns out that she was actually the daughter of the people we used to throw pennies at. So I didn't share that with her, but in hindsight, it probably would have been fun to let her know that. So weird world out there, just the way things kind of go down like that. This next poem was posted at Jerry Jazz Musician, which Joe Maida, the publisher, editor of that website, I think does a pretty nice job. And so thanks and big props to Joe. I know that some other local folks have had some work published with him. It's called At a Camp in Forest County. I'll first catch song from my father, a Steely Dan, churning in a tape deck between the thin walls of this two-room cabin, biting what I'll later come to dig, Horace Silver's opening bass notes, the piano vamp in a Joe Henderson solo, phrasing that sounds more like a blossoming. What began there, I'll come to know as Dad's midlife fade, wrapping itself in the echoing call of a hermit thrush, an acorn dropping a rim shot on the steel roof, his empty beers clinking on the glue-stained formica, where I'll build plastic models of hot rods. Now, pushing 50, I'm starting to hear the track's clave rhythm and staccato fills as the clipped replies of a man who made promises by night he'd never keep. Yet he'd nudge his son awake each school morning, smelling of speed stick and his first cigarette of the day, guzzling instant coffee before pulling the front door closed behind him. Back then, I couldn't know I'll someday be fatherless and without child, or that the Botman's biggest hit will come to fill my ears with what sounds like equal parts anthem and lament. This next poem is kind of pandemic related, and I had written this about a place that I could see from my window where I would do quite a bit of writing. It's called Social Distance. Even before this began, I found myself watching the neighbors getting tossed out of that rental with peeling brown paint, their husky and chihuahua no longer standing guard, barking at crunchy leaves and joggers blown by. Just days before, on an afternoon walk, I'd waved from across the two-lane we both called home, speeding cars keeping us at arm's length while the husband and wife smoked, their little boys, headless action figures strewn about the porch, one resting against a three-legged kitchen chair. Now, with their rusty Ford Ranger gone, a dingy Stars and Stripes sways there just above a patch of mud as the difficult talent of a white frigid air cools in that tiny yard, emptied of its ketchup and canned beer, the bottom door swinging slowly in the traffic's steady wash. This is one that goes out to a poem, trying to find a home. It goes out to a kid that I worked with. It's called Comfort, and it's in memory of Nigel Paga. Without warning, the busboy died in his bed after school. The genes of his heart finished ticking toward failure. And for guiding him through the world of service, his stepfather will bless me in Devlin's plush parlor among the sweet-smelling sprays of lilies and mums as I wait for my turn to kneel before the open casket, framing its body in repose, listening to the murmurs of others searching for answers after finding none in the prayer cards or small talk which follows. It'll take months and a slow dinner shift to get me thinking again of that awkward, shaggy boy, mocked for his smell and the way he'd puppy dog one patient waitress. His name, still listed on the wall-bound schedule, greets me as a weekly comfort, remind me of those down times when we'd talk film, Scorsese, his favorite, looking to widen the lens, I burned him copies of Pickpocket and Yojimbo, adding a few sets of techno I hoped he'd hear like a soundtrack. But tonight, finding a stack of discs marked in my scrawl after reading the server's side stand, I'm left unsure of what to do with worthless things, gathering in corners, like the memory of finding that young man having his first smoke with the dishwashers, telling lies and wearing greasy shoes, their laughter sprinkling the ground after every flick of ash. I'm going to finish up with one more restaurant poem and then a final one about an apartment I had in Oakland on Chesterfield. So this one goes out for the regulars, for Damien Scott and Vodka Paul, wherever you might be. 6 months into this mess, and what I'm missing are the bar regulars, denizens of a dinner shift's first hour, who kept me going during the downtimes, chatting them up when I should have been detailing the tables in my section. They'd come straight from work to sip their first Manhattan under the dim Edisons overhead, Coltrane's Lush Life sometimes falling like diamonds from the sound system as we rehash our days of raising hell before turning to cuss the Steelers or discuss the brilliance of John Cazale. We'll leave the third rails for later, though we did match cures for hiccups, with one of us downing a tablespoon of sugar as if it were a Hail Mary, being swallowed with those sticky grains melting on a midnight tongue. And this last poem comes from Scraping Away. It's called Demetrius's Glasses. And it goes out to anyone that's ever been to Chesterfield or perhaps who has lived there. Demetrius's Glasses. All the girls on acid sitting cross-legged on the carpet of his unfurnished bedroom would try them on. Thick lenses with brown plastic frames, his glasses could amplify the best hallucinations. Demetrius moved from the Y to sleep in a house of misfits and stoners. Sometimes he would vanish. We all feared daylight back then, not looking much beyond months emptied of their useless laughter. In those days, we looked shady, dressed in yellow, pasta-powered t-shirts, busboys at Spaghetti Warehouse, smoking joints in alleys between double shifts. The passing dog walkers never said a word. We haven't hung out for years. It's hard to know what to say now that he's blind. I remember slipping on those glasses, their magnified blur. Remember feeling helpless the way he must feel in the dark without them now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to all of our readers. I'm going to turn things over to Joan to round off the night.
Oh my gosh. Thank you all for reading for us tonight. Daniela, Paula, Justin, Rachel, and Fred, this was a great reading. It was so wonderful. I mean, we don't have to wait for July 4th for fireworks. There was joy, sadness, reflection. There was red gum bands and Chopin's Heart and Porsches and Neruda and Mickey Mantle and even John Cazale. How do you say his name? John Cazale?
Yeah.
I have written a poem about John Cazale. I might have to send it to you. Thank you. A big thank you to White Whale, and to Anna, of course, to Halsey, whom this is her second to last appearance here before she goes off to Miami to grad school. Whoa, Halsey, yay, thank you so much. And a huge thank you to Chris, who is my accomplice, co-conspirator in these readings. And I'm always so grateful because he finds something extraordinary and poignant to open the evening with so that we are lifted right up. Tonight it was Mickey Mantle. Okay. I'd just like to remind everybody that these readings will be available for your listening pleasure in probably about a week on the Hemingway's blog. Hemingway's, and you know about that. And that our next reading will be on July the 16th with Nikki Allen, John Dorsey, Patricia Jabe Wesley, Julie Spiker Kasdorf, and Stephen Lynn. And I have I think, inherited from these tendency to mispronounce people's names. I'm sort of definitely, I used to be able to do that on my own, but I think, you know, he really just encouraged me. He would have loved this reading. And I sent this, I just so you all know, I just sent a reminder of that this is all there to Gloria, because I want her to know that we are, we continue to move forward with this so that she can listen to. And she was married to Jimmy, as some of you know. So I'm personally, I just have to say, I am looking forward to this July 4th in a way I haven't for a while. I'm feeling a measure of hope and optimism, a sense that there are a lot of good people out there who care about this country and perhaps can together, you know, looking to work together, maybe we can move it forward as we have hoped for so long. And so I believe on Sunday, the weather is going to be sunny, not too hot. And I wish you a very gorgeous and thoughtful Independence Day. And thank you to all of our audience for coming out for this, for being being there for us, and all good wishes.
And if everybody wants to turn off their cameras and turn on their microphone and give one last round of applause before we say goodbye, thank you so much to Joan and Chris and all of our readers. Just so everybody knows, the events, I sent the email out for the How Was Your Event email a little early. So that's already sitting in your email. So enjoy, have a great night, and we'll see you at the next Hubs. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you,
everyone.
Bye. Peace out.